Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how AI can help us find more shade in our day-to-day lives, and a former hotshot on how joining the firefighting crew is beneficial beyond the fire lines. But first, the Affordable Care Act open enrollment period starts on Saturday, when people can sign up for new policies or renew or change the ones they already have. But there's a lot of uncertainty about the ACA right now, especially as it relates to how much policies might cost. Premiums are expected to rise by an average of 30%, according to the Washington Post, which reviewed documents from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That's on top of additional increases consumers could see if subsidies end. All of that could mean premiums that are two or three times as high as they are now. Senate Democrats have cited those subsidies and the need to extend them as the reason they're voting against measures to reopen the federal government. With me now to talk about what this all might mean for Arizonans shopping for health care coverage is Jen Longden, Chief External Affairs Officer with the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers. Jen, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
So what are you hearing from people who are maybe concerned, confused, feeling like they're not quite sure what they're supposed to do?
Yeah, I think that that includes most people at this moment. Folks understand that they're facing this spike in policies and their coverage costs and wanting to know what they need to do about it. And our navigators are working on that with them.
How challenging is it for navigators to try to help people navigate this when there is so much uncertainty?
Well, there are a number of issues that still aren't quite settled, but navigators have been training for this year's special circumstances, and they are prepared to help folks with assistance that is free. That's most important. This is free assistance, and it's unbiased. They don't steer folks to any one particular policy. They help people make the best decision they can.
What do you think the impact could be if costs go up as much as federal officials seem to think they are, and the premiums are not restored? Like, that seems like a pretty big cost increase for a lot of Arizonans, a lot of Americans.
Right. So, for example, Mark, a 60-year-old couple making about $80,000 a year could see their premiums jump from $560-odd to more than $2,000 a month if
Wow.
the subsidies expire. You know, I don't know anyone that can pay $2,000 a month for their health coverage.
So in a case like that, do you anticipate that there might be more people just going without?
I suspect we're going to see a rise in uncompensated care. I've heard folks talking about catastrophic policies that will cover, you know, catastrophes, but that won't necessarily help you with your monthly Eliquis for your hypertension or treatment for your diabetes or a lot of other conditions. So I do think that people are either going to forego care or we're going to see a huge rise in uncompensated care. And the system at this point really cannot take the additional burden of more uncompensated care.
Yeah, let's talk about that just a little bit, because obviously, you know, there are going to be some cuts in Medicaid coming in the next year or so, which will mean more people without health insurance. What does all that mean for the state's healthcare system if you have people who had been on Affordable Care Act coverage policies losing them, people who had been on Medicaid losing that? That doesn't seem great.
Agreed. And, you know, our healthcare system, especially our rural healthcare system and community health centers, have really worked incredibly hard to find every efficiency and savings that they have available to them. They operate on incredibly tight margins right now. So I don't know. I just don't know where we're going to find the additional money to continue to do the work. But it's our mission, and we will carry on.
Have you been hearing from navigators who are fielding questions from customers or potential customers about costs and what the costs might look like come Saturday?
I have not spoken directly with navigators, but our director of outreach and enrollment has been busy in that training process and hearing every bit of the concern from the folks who are dedicated to helping people get their coverage. They take these jobs in order to be helpful to members of their community. Many times, navigators are folks who found themselves in this situation of not knowing how to get health coverage. And in the process of working their own way through the system, dedicated themselves to helping others through as well.
So how do you think this ends? I mean, I hate to ask you a political question, but you are, of course, a former elected official. You served in the state
House of Representatives. You keep saying that, Mark.
I know, and I really do mean it. This is obviously a big issue in terms of the current situation in which the federal government finds itself, in the sense that it is shut down. I'm curious, like, look in your crystal ball for a second. How do you think this goes down?
Look, I think that the shutdown right now is predicated on this issue, right? Democrats refuse to take the votes necessary to reopen the government until there are guarantees around this issue. I think, as a former elected official, I would not want to be in my home district explaining to someone how their premiums rose $1,500 a month. So I am hoping that folks find their way through this and restore the coverage, the incentives that we need to keep people covered.
Let's assume that that happens and the premiums go back mm-hmm. into effect. Given mm-hmm. the sort of regular standard increases that CMS seems to think that policyholders are going to be dealing with, do you still think do you think the premiums or the subsidies are going to be enough to help folks either keep their coverage or get new coverage if they don't have it?
Well, I think coverage is still going to rise. I don't know how insurance companies plan to lower costs at this point in time. However, without marketplace coverage and without some of the other issues, we're going to continue to see more uncompensated care.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Jen Longden, Chief External Affairs Officer with the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers. Jen, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Magic mushrooms are illegal in Arizona, but as my next guest found, that doesn't mean Arizonans can't get related products in retail stores. And it also doesn't mean there's consensus on whether those products are safe to use. With me to talk about this is Hank Stevenson of the Arizona Agenda. Hank, good morning.
Happy Monday, Mark.
Happy Monday. I mean, so you really you took one for the team here trying some of these products out, huh?
Yeah, I figured my staff would mock me mercilessly if I just wrote a story about all these magic mushroom products, questioning if they are actually magic mushrooms and didn't do the basic work to find out myself.
It's dedication to the craft. So what are the kinds of products that one can buy and maybe that you did buy in stores across the state?
Well, that's kind of the big mystery. These things are labeled as magic mushroom products in, you know, some phrase or another, but none of them actually say what the active ingredients in these are. So I kind of turned to Reddit and poked around, see what the experts of Reddit knew. And they said, well, we think it's some other kind of mushroom. A lot of these things can be kind of, you know, processed in a way that removes their toxicity and enhances their regular psychoactive effects. And, you know, after quite a bit of work, I finally got a mycologist on the line. He said, yeah, the people at Reddit are right, surprisingly. So the best guess is there's a handful of other mushrooms that can be, you know, quote unquote psychedelic or magic. But generally, they take a lot more processing than the psilocybin mushrooms that anyone who grew up in the 1960s or 70s will remember well.
So what does that mean for the effect that these products will have on the body of a user?
Well, they work. I can tell you that much, Mark. Yeah, I mean, so I ate one gummy out of a pack of two gummies that said three gummies was a emoji face melting experience. And I wasn't expecting much out of it. I've eaten mushrooms in my life and kind of know what to expect from them. Popped one of these gummies, kind of forgot I did it, was walking around, and about an hour later I said, oh man, these are magic mushrooms, question one, check, figure that out. They are legitimate mushroom experience, whether or not they're slipping in some kind of psilocybin mushroom in this to get that experience, or whether it's truly another, magical blend of processed mushrooms, nobody really knows. And that's the real problem here. As drug innovation continues to outpace drug regulation, we just get weirder and weirder drugs with fewer and fewer regulations on them. Nobody really knows what they're taking. People have become sick from these off-brand mushroom products. In the past, last year, there was kind of a wave of one company had put out a bunch of products that were making people sick. And it seems like that was more, the company itself rather than the underlying plants. Maybe they weren't processing things correctly, but these are, certainly come with risks associated with eating mystery magic mushrooms.
Yeah.
But my experience was fine. Good times.
Good times. Well, so what is the legality? Because obviously you can't go into a store and buy an actual magic mushroom, at least not yet in Arizona. But are clearly the things that you bought are being sold in the open?
Yeah. I mean, I walk down to this liquor store near my house. I don't even drink, but my dog and I go down there to pick up a soda. And I've just seen these things on the shelf for a few months. And I kind of poked around a couple of different head shops, liquor stores in my neighborhood, and all of them have it. These are not hard to find. And they're basically impossible to regulate because we'd need the legislature to outlaw the kinds of mushrooms we assume that they're using. And then we'd need somebody to enforce that to go and, pick up samples of these things, see what they're actually using in, and decide whether it's illegal, which is just a whole headache. And the other thing to keep in mind is people's opinions, you said at least not in Arizona, psychedelic mushrooms aren't legal, but in a growing number of places, including Denver, they've been decriminalized. Or, even in Arizona, we've started pumping money into magic mushroom research to see if it can help, PTSD with vets and all sorts of other ailments. So I kind of wonder whether there's, a political will to go after these things and just constantly be chasing the next iteration of, some synthesized magic mushroom? Or is it more likely that the legislature at this point just, legalizes mushrooms to some degree? Because that's the path we're heading down with these kind of research things that we've been doing in recent years.
Well, and it kind of sounds, Hank, like what you're describing in terms of trying to track down, each iteration of magic mushroom that some scientist somewhere might come up with. It kind of sounds like the issue that law enforcement has and to some extent continues to have with different iterations of cannabis, of THC, that kind of thing, that there's just consistently new versions of it. And, at a certain point, you can't make a new law for every new chemical compound.
Exactly. And every year there's some new kind of chemical compound drug that's being outlawed at the legislature. But I kind of came into this thinking about the fight over Delta 8 and Delta 9 products. I don't know, earlier this year, BevMo and a bunch of other major retailers were selling essentially, THC, cannabis, marijuana drinks, because there was some sort of provision in the federal farm bill that dealt with hemp and, kind of loosened the constraints on hemp products. And these are technically derived from hemp, so they thought they could get away with it. The AG's office stepped in and kind of made some threats. If you keep selling these drinks, clearly you're not a cannabis dispensary. You can't do that. And everyone backed off. And this is kind of a very similar thing, except for we don't have, an underlying drug to say this is illegal. If they were putting little bits of psilocybin in this, they could be regulated, but because presumably they're not, there's not much the law can do unless the law changes.
Right. That'll be interesting to keep an eye on. All right. That is Hank Stevenson with the Arizona Agenda, perhaps our trippiest guest of the day. Hank, thanks as always.
Anytime, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how the dangerous job of wildland firefighting gave a struggling young adult the structure they needed to stay alive. We'll hear from an author of a new memoir about their experience on hotshot crews. But first, if you need to get from point A to point B, there are apps that'll show you the fastest route or the shortest route or even the route with the fewest tolls if you're in a place with them. But until now, you've not really been able to see the shadiest route, as in the coolest one in which you'll spend the least amount of time in the sun. Hua Wei is an assistant professor in the School of Computing and Augmented Intelligence at ASU and has been working on ways to incorporate artificial intelligence into making information about shade more available and accessible. The result? Two projects that come at the issue from different angles. As part of our occasional series called Throwing Shade, Wei joins me to talk more about his work. And Hua, how big of a role do you think AI could play in increasing shade and access to it?
I would say a lot, because right now, think about a shade or think about a simple map that we have in the map providers in Google or Apple. They don't provide any like shade map. And I think that is really something that we need in Phoenix, not only in Phoenix, but I feel like for the worldwide cities like in Paris, in South Africa, and in China, in Japan, we need that. A lot of cities are undergoing the heat wave.
Yeah. So you mentioned something like Google Maps or Apple Maps, and it sounds as though one of your projects, which is called Shaded Route Planning, it almost sounds like it's sort of Google Maps, but instead of just having options for like if you want to drive, if you want to take public transit, if you want to walk, that kind of thing, it also adds an option for what is the shadiest route. Is that a fair analogy?
Yeah, you're right. So that kind of like a Google Map, but instead of telling you the fastest route, it can also tell you the coolest one or the combination, like 50% of fastest and 50% of coolest. So we use AI models to detect the shade directly from satellite images and lines that up with each sidewalk and bike passes.
Do you find that it matters what kind of shade it is, be it natural or man-made, in terms of the kind of impact it might have on somebody traveling through a city?
I think it matters when you have different, when you are in different cities. I feel like in Phoenix, as long as you are in the shade, no matter if it's a structural shade from the buildings or the tree, the shade from the tree, it helps. But for those cities who have like white heat, not dry heat, I think the structural shade matters more.
So let me ask you about the other project you're doing, Deep Shade. And this is one where it almost sounds like a planning tool where you're sort of using AI to figure out where shade is going to be. Am I getting that about right?
Yeah, you're right. So that's sort of like a movie. So it actually predicts how the shadows will move throughout the day. It's a generative AI model. So you can ask, what does downtown Phoenix looks like at 4 p.m. tomorrow or 4 p.m. in July 4th. So they will literally draw the shadows where they should be.
And is this the kind of tool that you can use to sort of figure out, you know, if you want to have shade in a particular place, like what kind of structure or what kind of tree might need to be in that place to make it shady at a particular time, maybe even on a particular day?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. So I think this one is going to be very helpful for the urban planning. So if you want to have a shade over there at a certain time of the day, we can design how high the building or how high the tree should be and in order to cover that area.
So you mentioned, you know, this might be helpful in city planning and in trying to think about, you know, ways that this might be useful, you know, things like where to put a park or maybe where to put a bus stop or how to shade those kinds of things are ones that come to mind. But I'm guessing that there are instances that maybe aren't as readily obvious where this could be useful.
Yeah, I think like one direct thing we could the city planners can do is use the shade map that we developed to figure out where, which part of the city or which part of the route like do not have any shade. Then they want to connect some part of it to make sure there is a certain route that is always under the shade. Preferably, they would have pedestrians going from one direction to a bus stop, and they want to make sure that people commute to the bus stop, and that route, specific route, is under the shade. That is one direct thing that we can think of. The other ones I can think of is this: the schools and universities, when they are having students running through different buildings and how they can plan for the trees and for the buildings to make sure they have the shade covered for the routes.
So obviously, Phoenix has a goal of having a certain percentage of the city, you know, with shade canopy. Have you had conversations with anyone within the city about how to maybe work with this tool to help make that happen?
Yeah, actually, we're really lucky to be in Arizona because the local governments here get how serious the heat problem is. And right now, we're working with city planning and sustainability teams to bring our shade data into the workflows.
How much do you think that this tool can help in that effort?
For example, they can use the tools to spot areas that are super exposed, like neighborhood without tree cover or bus stops with no shade, and prioritize those for improvement. That is just a simple idea. But having actual numbers or visualizations help them make data-driven decisions, not just rely on intuition.
Well, I guess when you talk about data-driven decisions and you're talking about cities, it often also includes money. And I would think that cities would be maybe a little reluctant to spend money on shade, or maybe more apt to spend money on shade if they had, you know, a model like this that said, OK, this is we're pretty sure this is going to work, as opposed to we hope this is going to work.
Yes, you're right. So this is going to be when they have a budget and where they want to plant or plan first, and this data and this quantitative evaluation gonna be the thing that gonna be helpful for them.
How else do you think that you might be able to use AI to solve the problem of shade?
I think AI is really well positioned to solve this problem because previously, before AI, people are using the real simulations. Like they have to run, set up their simulators, and they have to know exactly where the plant's height and what is the building's height. They build 3D simulations, and they have to place where the sun could be in certain day of the year. But with the simulations or the AIs, generative AI, we can just input text and AI with well-trained data, and then we can basically generate shade very easily. We do not rely on the expert simulators anymore.
All right. That is Hua Wei, an assistant professor of computer science and engineering in the School of Computing and Augmented Intelligence at ASU. Hua, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. One of the first actions President Trump took when he entered the White House for his second term was to stop the arrival of refugees to U.S. shores. Now, the New York Times is reporting his administration has plans to cut refugee admissions to record lows, reserving most of the slots for white Afrikaners from South Africa. Historically, Arizona has received some of the highest numbers of refugees in the country. So this morning, we're going to take a few minutes to hear about a program here that helps refugees learn a new skill and find a new community. Shop Refugee teaches refugee women how to sew and then sells their goods, giving them the profits. My co-host Lauren Gilger sat down with sewing manager Michelle Rogers and intern Allie Flint to talk more about it.
Our parent organization, Go10, is a training program, and somewhere around 2021, they decided, let's just do a little sewing night for the ladies, and then it kind of turned into a class, and it just kept growing from there, and shortly after, they were selling online at shoprefugee.com.
Right. Okay, so you have women refugees from all over the world, it sounds like, who come to this class, and it's grown quite a bit since then, it sounds like, right?
Yes, it has. So we are first a training program. We are targeted towards refugee women who want to further their skills and some sort of job training. And we're unique to the job training because our demographic is stay-at-home refugee mothers. Mm. And they don't have a lot of time and resources to go to a full job training program. So this program is accessible to them because we offer 1 to 2 days English classes and sewing classes in the morning, and we provide childcare for both of them.
Wow. Oh, so childcare is an important part of
this.
I know. Yes. I have kids. That's great. So you bring in these women, you teach them this skill, and then the way this is set up, right, like with donated materials, et cetera, they get to keep almost all the profits.
Correct. So we depend solely on donated fabrics, materials that we then are able to create unique items, because these are materials that people have had probably around in their house for a few years. And so they're older, but that means they're better. And so because everything is donated and we have zero cost, we are able to give the women 95% back of the purchase price to supplement their family income in a small way. And it's a place of community for them to find friendship and community with others that are possibly from their country, but also to make American friendships. Refugees connected with an American friend have a higher success rate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're teaching a skill, you're giving them a little supplemental income, but it sounds like it's about community.
It's about
much more.
It's
about friendship. A lot of these women know each other, live in the same communities, right? And many are from, it sounds like, Afghanistan?
Yes, they could live in the same community. We have right now in class, our largest percentage is from Afghanistan. We have a few from Myanmar, Iraq, and one from Ethiopia.
Wow. Okay. So tell us a little bit about what this class is like. Ali, you're interning there. You're kind of volunteering, getting to know this. You didn't sew before, but you're learning.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about bringing all these women in and helping with this. What's it like?
Yeah, I think a big part of why I enjoy volunteering with Shop Refugee is just like the diversity of women from all different cultures, all different languages are being spoken, and different ages. And it really is just such a loving community. And we get to just be with them as they learn this skill. And as I'm an intern and I've never really sewn before, I'm really just there to be their friend and encourage them along the way. So,
yeah. How do you get over the language barrier here? I'm assuming there are many different languages being spoken in that room.
Yeah, it is kind of chaotic sometimes, but it is kind of empowering to empower women who speak the same language to like translate for each other, and also just like communicating not through words, but just through like you get creative.
Yeah.
And just like the love shows through, and just being with them, your presence is really meaningful to these women.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Spending the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us some of the stories of some of these women that you've met and been able to make friends with over the years.
Yeah. So I'm really close with a lot of refugee women, and they are just so loving and so hospitable, and it's just almost aggressive hospitality sometimes. They just really take us in, which is amazing because we're here to welcome them to the United States, but really they're welcoming us into their families and their homes. And I have several refugee women who call me their daughter, their granddaughter, their sister. And so it's really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, I'm sure, especially coming from a place like Afghanistan, people who have gotten refugee status here have been through a lot. Did you always sew, Michelle?
I have always sewn.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why? What do you like about it?
I have a long line of seamstresses in my family. It's been passed down. We've been sewing and quilting since very young. So there's a number of things I enjoy about it. And I think it's the same things that the ladies enjoy about it is you get to create something from nothing. That's always rewarding. You find like-minded other creators and you get to have relationship with them and talk about your craft.
All kinds of benefits.
All kinds of benefits.
So what was it like for you kind of taking those skills you already had in sewing and applying them in this way and kind of creating this community of women?
Yeah. So when you teach them some of these skills, you see the connection right away and the excitement that they have as they get to create something. And it has purpose outside of just a hobby. It can grow into a business for themselves, or they could get a job at a local business.
Right. And you've had some women do that, right? Like be able to take these skills and go get another job.
We have. We have referred a few women to some of our connections. It's my goal to have them learn from scratch. So we start with making our own pattern, and then they create it, and then they have that to keep. And then they go ahead and make the product, and we have different stages of products from beginner to advanced. And when they've mastered that product and done it two or three times without help, then we give them materials to go home with, and then they can work on their own time. Mm. And then the best part is they bring us back products, and they're so proud to come in and show us the items they've created this week. And then I take pictures of them and put them and list them online for them.
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly a little bit about, I guess, the thing that strikes me about this is that it's like this little thing, right? Like, it's not a full-time career for a lot of these women. It's not a ton of money. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like it's really rewarding for them.
Yes, it is. And I think it's the same thing for them as it was for me. My grandma sew, and I sew a quilt with them. And I think they maybe had that connection as well at home. And they no longer have that. They've left their families, many of them. Mm-hmm. And so they're making new connections, new community. And it's just a really great bond to have in Sewing Circle. And it's like a lot of our grandmas went to Sewing Circle and quilting bees, and we're kind of bringing that back.
Bringing it back. All right. Michelle Rogers, Allie Flint, thank you both so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Trump is continuing his trip to Asia today with a stop in Japan, where he'll meet with that country's new prime minister. And many observers are waiting for later in the week when the president meets with China's leader. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Audrey Tinlin in London. And Audrey, what do other Asian countries hope to get out of this presidential visit?
Exactly. All eyes on China. But of course, he's already been in Malaysia, where at least six trade agreements have been signed with four countries. And some of these deals involve critical minerals. So, for example, one of the deals with Malaysia that will boost America's access to critical minerals at a time, of course, when China has been tightening its controls. And Malaysia has said it will not ban or impose quotas on exports to the US of these critical minerals. And in return, Washington has agreed to set a 19% tariff on Malaysian goods. And some goods might even see zero tariffs. So that's the sort of thing that these countries have been looking for. Thailand now has a similar level of tariff deal with the US, along with Cambodia. And these sorts of deals come amid these competing efforts with Beijing, which we'll hear about later in the week, because this is a very fast-growing sector. These minerals are needed for semiconductors, electric vehicles, military equipment, all of them growth industries. So this all came as President Trump also approved deals with Cambodia and Thailand, what he's calling a peace agreement, what other people are calling a truce agreement. And of course, President Trump took the credit for that. And now the focus is on Japan, where President Trump has already arrived. And President Trump has landed a $550 billion investment pledge from Tokyo. And that's in exchange for lowering US tariffs on Japanese cars. And this visit will also allow the president to get to know Japan's first female prime minister. And she appears to share President Trump's views on building up defense spending in a country that already hosts the biggest concentration of US forces overseas.
Interesting. So, Audrey, let's go from Asia now to South America, where the self-styled anarcho-capitalist president of Argentina is celebrating after his party won big in midterm elections. He's, of course, a favorite of President Trump. So what will he do, Audrey, with his renewed mandate now?
Now, your listeners might remember Javier Milei as the politician who likes to wield a chainsaw at his rallies, and he even gifted one to Elon Musk. The point there was to show that he was willing to cut red tape and public spending. And in the first 2 years of office, he has done that. He's also managed to cut inflation in Argentina, a country that suffered from runaway inflation in the past. So in recent weeks, though, the wheels appear to have come off Milei's revolution. Doubts have come up over his political future, and that spooked the markets and triggered a sharp sell-off of the currency. Now, the US then came to the rescue. President Trump has extended Argentina a potential $40 billion bailout to help bolster its currency. And that is up today after this big win and after that bolstering. All of this does seem to have worked. Milei's party won that unexpected victory in yesterday's midterm elections, 40% of the nationwide vote is what they won. So the plan now appears to be to continue with the Make Argentina Great Again campaign. But Argentina's people are bracing for further cuts and economic restructuring. In fact, Fitch Ratings Agency has said in the past few days that the US support for Argentina's markets has prevented a downgrade of its credit rating, but the country needs a broader plan to rebuild foreign exchange reserves in order to earn an upgrade.
So, Audrey, let's go now to Egypt, where a grand opening is scheduled for the end of the week. This is, of course, the land of the pharaohs and is hoping for a big boost to tourism when it opens a massive billion-dollar museum to showcase the treasures of the pyramids. But am I right? There's kind of a saga attached to this project.
Yeah, there very much is. The Grand Egyptian Museum, as it's called, officially opens later this week just outside Cairo. But it's actually taken longer to complete this spectacular museum than it did to construct the Great Pyramid of Giza itself.
Wow.
Construction of that pyramid is estimated to have taken between 15 and 30 years. A lot of experts think about 20 years. But the museum has been in the works for 23 years. A lot of that's been outside the control of the museum's operators. The country has experienced the Arab Spring, a military coup, COVID-19 and a tourism downturn. So the project is now finally finished and Egypt's hoping it will attract millions more tourists to visit the country each year and to spend their money. It does sound like there's lots to see. For the first time, there'll be a gallery containing all of the more than 5,000 pieces of the collection of golden finds from the tomb of Tutankhamun. And they'll all be in one place for the first time since the discovery of the pharaoh's tomb back in 1922. So Egypt says this is set to become the largest museum in the world dedicated to a single civilization. And it also hopes that it will have fantastic conservation and research facilities that people will come from all over the world to study what Egypt has to offer. And it's a country that really does need a bit of a boost from the foreign exchange that tourists could bring. So let's wait and see if they'll be able to go smoothly from now on.
Yeah, sounds like it should be something to see. All right. That is the BBC's Audrey Tinlin in London. Audrey, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. River Selby had a tough time in their teenage years. They grew up in what they describe as a chaotic environment and struggled with addiction. They worked odd jobs, including as a stripper, basically doing whatever work they could get. And then a friend who'd worked on a contract firefighting crew suggested Selby try it. The path to finding direction, though, was not a straight one.
It was a roundabout process. I actually, when I was 19, I had dropped out of community college. I was living in Eugene, Oregon. I was a mess as a human being.
But Selby says that started to change once they decided to give wildland firefighting a chance. They tell that story in their first book out earlier this year called Hotshot, A Life on Fire.
I was definitely not the typical person to do it. And but I would try anything. So I went to the compound for the contractor and filled out the application, went to all the classes, did the day of training. And my boss later told me he was sure I was not going to come back the next day after our field training because I was not having an easy time. And I did come back and I ended up really loving the job.
What did you love about it?
Like I said, I grew up in a really chaotic environment. I moved often, sometimes several times a year. I lived with a single mom. And when I didn't live with her, I lived with my grandparents. And so I didn't have structure. And wildland firefighting gave me structure. I knew when I was expected to wake up in the morning. I knew what was expected of me. I knew that if I worked as hard as I could, that I would gain some sort of respect. And I loved being outside. I'd always loved being outside, grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I just loved being out there. And also, especially on the contract crew, it was just a very diverse people that I worked with.
So what was it like for you as a hotshot? Because as you say, that's an elite firefighting crew. Also, it's a pretty dangerous job.
Yeah. So I worked on three different hotshot crews, and I feel grateful that I worked on three different crews because each hotshot crew is its own culture. My first hotshot crew, I came on and they hadn't had, I identify as non-binary now, but I did not back then. So I came on as the first woman that they had had in years. And it was kind of a joke that they said I was hired because of affirmative action. And there was a lot going on that crew that was very uncomfortable for me was difficult. But physically, the job was so much more demanding than being on the contract crew, because you're working with the same 18 to 22 people for 6 months. And, you know, my first year, 16-hour days, 14 to 21 days in a row, depending, 2 to 3 days off maybe, and then right back out. It was just a very physically, mentally intense environment to be in. And that was challenging. And then the other two crews that I worked on were easier for me because the culture was more welcoming to women. And I also, both of those crews, I wasn't the only one. There were two women on the crew.
When you have that kind of job with that kind of schedule, with those kinds of demands, is it possible, do you have time, did you have time to really process, either just by yourself or with your crewmates there, some of the difficulties that you had, especially early on, of being the only female on an all-male crew? Or later on, you know, there were a few women, but still male-dominated. Like, was it possible to process that either yourself or with your crewmates and talk about things that were difficult or things that maybe were said that were not okay with you, things like that? Or was it just work, work, work all the time and deal with that stuff later?
In my experience, and you know, keep in mind that this is in the 2000s, although I don't think things have changed much from what I've heard. Hotshot culture, again, is very similar to military culture, very similar to Marine, Navy SEAL, like high, I don't even know what to call it, the more macho military culture, where you don't complain about things, you don't talk about your feelings, you do your work. And really, as a woman in that environment, there are a couple choices. You can either assimilate and act like a man, or you can say something about things that make you uncomfortable and face whatever backlash you're going to get for that. On some crews, you're not going to get any backlash. On other crews, you are going to get a lot of backlash. And I left my first crew because I wasn't able to kind of be accepted in having my boundaries as a person on that crew.
So how have you taken what you learned as a firefighter, as a hotshot, into your post-wildland firefighting career?
Well, so I left fire in 2010. At the end of my last season was in Alaska. And I left and I really wanted to go back to school and be a writer. And I went to community college, finished that, and then went to Syracuse University. They gave me some scholarships, and I realized that I had an incredible work ethic. And that is something that I took from wildland firefighting. I'm so grateful for the work ethic that I learned as a wildland firefighter, because I really did learn that I was capable of so much more than I thought I was. And so much of it, even the physical things, so much of it was mental and about what I thought I could do. And if I could kind of get past these mental blocks I had of I can do this or I can do that, then literally I could do anything I set my mind to. And truly, like, when I left fire, I said, I want to be a writer. I want to write books. That's what I want. And I didn't have a college degree. Neither of my parents graduated from high school. My dad didn't graduate from middle school. Like, that was not something that I had grown up thinking I could do. And now I'm getting my first book published.
I mean, it sounds like that, like, had you not joined the firefighting crews to begin with, like safe to say that you would not have discovered that about yourself? Or if you had, it maybe would have taken a lot longer and, you know, you might have had more trauma along the way doing it?
I will be totally honest and say that if I had not started fighting fires, I don't know if I would be alive today, because I was headed in a very negative trajectory. So I truly do think that wildland firefighting, that job helped to keep me alive. And it's so ironic because it's a dangerous job, but it really did, I think, save my life. Like, if I look back and I think, you know, what would I have done if I hadn't done that? I don't think that I would have lived past the age of like 23 or 24, to be totally honest.
All right. That is River Selby, a former hotshot and writer. Newest book is called Hotshot, A Life on Fire. River, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. A reminder, you can sign up and probably should sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. And while you're online, just follow us on Instagram as well. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.